It's just, I know, but it's just funny to ask somebody working at Funny or Die, you guys make a lot of videos?
I just happen to know the...
I was on the homepage of that Funny or Die the other day.
Yeah. A lot of videos on there.
Yeah. Are we recording then? Oh, great. I didn't know if we were recording or not.
We are.
Sometimes I was recording where a guy was, John Harris, who you may or may not know, he's great, was playing himself, insinuating that he was about to rub peanut butter on a dog's balls and lick it off.
Oh, that's what you were doing today.
That's what I was just doing right before I left.
Well, a lot of times we just have to come to terms that we are full-grown adults, and our job is to merchant in the silly.
We do. We are silly merchants. It's true.
And that is a long-form conversation. Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell. Hello, America. I am on fire today. How are you? Welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversation Podcast. My name is Sean Diston, and I'm here with my co-host, Nicole Dressbell. How are you, Nicole?
I'm well, thank you.
She is well, thank you. And we are here with our illustrious guest, the professional, the very strong-bodied, the never aggressive, but always
assertive.
Matt Mayer. How are you, Matt Mayer? Good to see you.
I'm well. Thank you. For a second there, I started sounding like a wine.
Sometimes, like the oaky.
full-bodied.
Hello, Matt.
Hi.
So this is an interesting episode, I think, for both me and Nicole, because we are very good friends, the three of us.
Yes.
Like. Indeed.
Go ahead,
both of these two were in my wedding party.
Yeah.
Very true.
That is very good.
About that.
A co-best man.
Wow.
Yep.
This is this might be the most intimate episode of the show ever.
I think so.
Very intimate. This might also be the closest the three of us have ever sat.
That's also true.
Yeah. Also it's got to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely the most intimate for the three of us, because we could probably bring in somebody. You would be intimate.
Right. Like a Kevin was very intimate for me.
Yeah, and I feel attached to Kevin as well, but like
I lived with Matt. I was in his wedding party.
Five
years. Exactly. Yeah. But Matt feels like the middle point of the triangle of like people that you and I are equally close to.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think my relationship with you, Nicole, is very much based on the times I've spent with Matt and you, you know, beach house days.
Mm-hmm.
These are all things nobody knows about.
I think I would unabashedly say, if in conversation and one or either of you were brought up, I would say best friend, not one of my best friends.
Right,
yes,
right.
We discussed this a lot. Because at some point in time, I decided to just refer to you as my best friend.
Yeah,
and I was like,
no reason.
You should know I've been doing this.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yes, yeah, I remember that. yes, and thank you. I appreciate it. I want to know what's being said about me.
Yes.
So, well, welcome, Matt. And we start every one of these interviews in the same way.
Yes.
Nicole?
Great. So, Matt, when you started taking improv classes at the UCB, would you let us know who you were, where you were, and what you were doing?
Matt seems pretty disgusted by most of the things happening.
Okay.
So, yeah, before you started taking classes, who were you? Paint a picture. Give us our baseline reality here.
Well, let's see. My name was Matt Mayer.
Okay.
I was a recent college graduate, where I'd spent 5 years at the University of Maryland, and at the end of which I had decided maybe I should take a stab at this comedy thing. I'd been doing stand-up for a little bit. I'd just learned about long-form improv.
Before we move into that, what got you into stand-up in college? Because you were doing some stand-up when you were at Maryland, right?
That's yeah. Basically, a childhood friend, Brian Golding, who was going to George Washington at the time, probably my junior year, he sent me an email. He was like, I just did this stand-up, like, competition thing at my school, and it's coming to your school, so you should sign up and do it. And like if we both get first and second place at our places, we'll both do sets at the DC Improv.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did it, and I he moved on, and I did not.
Right.
He had already gone, and by the time he was emailing me, he had actually already been told he was moving on. And I did poorly. I tried to jam like 12 minutes of material that I had just written and never done before into 5 minutes of set time, and like managed to do it, meaning I just talked at a clip.
What do you think? Do you remember any of it? What was your best piece from
it? Oh, my best piece? I couldn't tell you.
Worst.
I couldn't tell you. I probably couldn't tell you two of them, but the one I remember was just a thing about sexuality in Disney movies. It was just that. I can't remember the actual joke. Oh, wait. I had a second joke now that I remember. Just something about how much. I can't remember the punchlines. They probably weren't even punchlines.
Yeah, it probably was just like, Disney movies are getting sexual, right? Anyways, yeah, you guys go down to campus and everything's going to the bookstore. Just a constant stream of consciousness. Did your friend ask you to do this because you were generally known as a funny person, or you thought you were a funny person, or was that something that was already in your life?
Yeah, that was kind of something that was already in my life. He and I were, like, we weren't a friend circle or anything. We were friends from Hebrew school.
Oh,
we were like two people that were friends and didn't really have other friends.
Right.
From that group, at least. And so we always hung out. We would watch like Conan O'Brien. I mean, this was honestly a lot of him driving that. Like
right.
He loved Conan. So we would watch it all the time. We went to see it a couple times. So we
What's
lived
his
near
name?
New York. Brian Golding.
Great.
And
still doing comedy, Brian?
No, but he's in production. He does work in TV.
Oh, interesting.
But he. Yeah, so we would do that, and I think he just was like, I did it, and I know Matt's at Maryland. I think it was honestly
just like this person's it. Yeah. And randomly that kind of got you the bug of like, maybe I should try doing stand-up a little bit.
And I did it that one time, and it was like, I knew that I did not do well, but I was like, this is super, super fun. So I started looking up, back then, more so than now. I was pretty megalomaniacal.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the Who.
Important part of the Who.
Yes, agreed. And so I was like, I liked the attention. I was the mascot at Maryland.
Right.
And that was fun.
Let's talk about that for one quick brief second.
Sure.
Matt Mayer was the turtle, the terrapin.
The terrapin.
You were in the costume. You were like basically in front of 80,000 people.
Yeah.
Right?
A lot
at a football
times.
Game or something?
Yeah. We had like. Bird Stadium was like maybe like 60 or something like that. 65.
So you're already a person that's like, I need attention. You're drinking up this attention.
Yeah,
you're getting
but I've got the mask on.
But you've got the mask on. So now
my first stand-up special would have been called Matt Mayer, Underneath the Mask or something like that.
Underneath, not unmasked? Underneath the mask?
I thought about unmasked and I was like, no, I'm going to wear the mask when I do the special.
So. That's so funny.
So it's telling you that Matt Mayer is the one underneath
the mask. Right, so man, it's just so funny because even just the thought to jump into being the mascot. So, okay, so you get the bug a little bit.
I don't know if that's interesting, but there is a story behind that.
And what is the story?
And it feels like, I kind of feel like I'm on, like my life is a ride I just happen to be on. That's
right.
How it feels a lot of times.
Right.
I don't often feel like I'm driving it. And the becoming the mascot is definitely one of those cases. Long story short, as I can think to manage, I went to an accepted student open house at the University of Maryland and just sat in the front row with my friends and was being goofy. Again, their idea to sit in the front and
right.
be goofy. And I was like, just like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, like getting like, you know, little cakes or whatever up, away from where the actual orientation happened, the dean of students who had been giving a presentation at the thing came up to me and was like, you're going to be the next mascot. And I was like, huh? And
what?
He was like, you got charisma. Like, he said some garbage like that. And he just was like, all right. I was like, okay. And then I decided to look it up and see how to do it.
Whoa.
And then that was it. Yeah.
That's pretty random.
That is really random.
I wonder if that person knows that kind of set you along a path that has changed your life.
Path. He has no idea.
That's so
I actually wanted to find him and tell him. But by the time I became the mascot a year later, he was no longer the dean.
There. Oh, yeah. Interesting. So
admissions.
You're doing some stand-up, you get the bug, you like the attention, you start looking up open mics, I guess?
Yeah, I started looking up open mics in the, like, D.C., Northern Virginia, Maryland area, and did a couple. Very, pretty infrequently, definitely compared to what you'd think of, like, hitting
right,
the open
hitting
mic
the open
scene.
Mics.
I probably did, like, one a month or two a month or something.
And then you find out about improv.
No, actually, kind of what happened was kind of concurrently with this, or maybe like right after this, I decided to stop doing this extracurricular thing I did that was like a no experience necessary gymnastics thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe we got all the way through the mascot stuff without pointing out that. Matt Mayer's a gymnast.
Oh my God.
It's a crazy
ride. It was
no
experience necessary. I thought it'd be fun to jump on a trampoline a few hours a day for a few years, and I did, and I had a great time. But it was like a thing where you couldn't drink or smoke or do drugs. Mm-hmm. Not that I like really wanted to do drugs, but then I didn't drink till I turned 21. Then I turned 21. And I was like, yeah, I kind of want to drink. So I didn't want to do that and cheat on the group and all that.
So you quit that group.
So I quit that group and was looking for an extracurricular thing because that was like 15 hours a week or something. It was like crazy.
Were you still in college at that point?
Yeah. So that was where we are now, I guess, in the story. Though it jumps around, is like beginning of my senior, like fourth year. So
your first senior year.
My first, that is correct. Yes, Nicole, I spent two senior years. That's the way I like to think of it.
So but, did I.
Right. Jesus Christ.
I did it at mine on purpose, so I took one class a couple semesters.
Yeah, that's kind of what I did too.
But if you hadn't, your life would be much worse.
My life would be much worse. As Nicole knows, in the last couple weeks of my time at Maryland in my fifth year, I met my now wife.
Okay, that's not important. Let's talk about improv.
Okay, yes.
Come on.
I'm just kidding.
Hi, Durf. Hi, the Durf. I love you.
Okay. I don't like that.
I loved it.
Tell me how you discovered this improv thing.
So I'm like, let me find something to do. And some friends, again, friends taking me. Friends took me earlier in my time at college to this group. To see this sketch group called SketchUp, and they were like super, super funny, and I really liked them. They had a friend in the group, and they were older friends of mine. And so I was like, oh, let me audition for SketchUp, because that'll be fun. And so I did that, and I got a call back, and then I did not get asked to join the group, and then auditioned again the next semester and didn't get a call back. And it just felt kind of fishy because you can kind of feel, especially when like there's a bunch of people going all at once, you kind of get a feel for like how it's going. I was like, I feel like I was doing pretty good. Something felt weird.
Yeah.
And somebody who left the group later told me that it seemed to him to have been something personal between me and one of the people in the group, but I didn't know anybody in the group. So I was like, I don't know what that means. But I do know that I want to do comedy and I don't need to rely on these people to do it. So I decided to just start a comedy group the next
year. Right. I forget about this. So what were they called again?
The Bureau.
The Bureau.
Yeah.
Right.
So I started the Bureau, which did, and you know, in my idealist, because this is like probably, you know, a large part of the who am I. I'm like kind of getting out of this phase by the time I get up to New York. But I was, man, in high school and college, I was such an idealist. I mean, like I said, I didn't drink till I turned 21. I had these like kind of pretensions and I was like, yeah, no, we'll be a group that does sketch comedy and improv comedy and stand up comedy. Like, why put borders on it? You know, like that was kind of my attitude. And it was hard to wrangle all that stuff, but I didn't know anything about improv. And all I knew of improv was short form at the time. So we did that and I was doing stand up and I met some people and in particular this guy, Rory Scovel.
Famous stand-up comedian.
Famous stand-up comedian, great improviser. Yeah, I met him and he had been telling me, he started telling me like right around when I started the Bureau, like, I'm doing this improv thing, man. You got to come check it out. I'm like, yeah, I'll pass. Thanks, man. Really not a good friend about it.
Right, right.
And then eventually by the, like very close to the end of the school year, I went and saw him perform with his group, Dr. Fantastic, and they were paired with a team called Jackie. And Jackie and Dr. Fantastic both had now New York improviser Zubin Parang on it. I want to say maybe Zach Phillips was on Jackie at the time, but I could be wrong about that.
I think that might be right.
And then, yeah, it was just, it was really, it blew my mind. Like the very way that I'm sure anybody who's listening felt the first way they saw long form improv.
Right.
Jackie did a dream, which is a, like, they interviewed somebody about their dream and then they did improv based on that dream. And then Dr. Fantastic did a thing that nobody does. It'd be very difficult to describe. Very fast, almost joke. It's like basically like improvising blackout sketches and then wrangling them all together as best you can. Very high energy, very goofy. But I was like, oh, I love that. We're never doing short form again. I don't know what this is, but let's figure out how to do it. And so somebody on the group had heard of Truth in Comedy.
Right.
And started reading it, and we tried to kind of make it work out of that. And yeah, so by the end of it, we were doing long-form improv.
Is the Bureau still a team now?
As far as I know, yeah. There's a couple people up in New York from that started after I graduated, like Pat Wise and Trevor Lyons.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Interesting. Yeah. So you were at the very forefront of what is now a college team that exists and has made more comedians. I think that's very interesting.
That's really interesting.
You don't have any involvement with them now, obviously.
No, I kind of tried to keep it going. One of the things I really liked about the college thing was they would have like alumni shows and stuff like that.
Right, right.
But I was so much older than everybody in the group when I was there, and then I was gone after a year.
Right, so you've kind
so
of
all that stuff I wanted to establish, I wouldn't have never have had time. You can't do an alumni show your first year, you know?
And you can't come back a decade later and be like, kids, we're doing an alumni show.
Exactly. And I kind of tried to do that.
I know. That doesn't surprise me.
And they were like, I don't know who you are.
Totally. And I went down and I
that's great.
Coached some improv and gave notes on sketches and stuff, and it was great to see them do their stuff. But yeah, I think that kind of thing maybe fell by the wayside, or maybe I'm just not involved because I was never, you know, I don't know. I know so few alumni, just the ones from my year, really.
Right.
So.
And Nathan Yaffe, actually, who works for College Humor, came up.
So how did you get to New York, and when did you, what brought you to UCB? Was it all kind of one felt swoop? I mean, you are from Jersey, so the New York kind of thing wasn't that big a jump.
Yeah, New York was definitely like a default.
It was the non-choice.
It was the non-choice, for sure. It was like going back home, basically. And I moved in, I'd stayed the summer after college to paint a mural at a California Tortilla.
Right. Also, Matt Mayer was an artist in college, and many paintings that in my apartment now are Matt Mayer originals. But let's continue. We could talk forever about Matt's
all the things
college
that I've quit.
Life.
Yeah. the world's greatest quitter. Mm. I stayed, and partly to see the DERF when I could, but the DERF went to Spain for the summer, so I didn't really see her. But I hung out around campus and painted that mural, and then I went home. I moved home for like a month or two, started taking UCB classes in that time, and while I was taking my first class, moved to Hoboken, where my best friend Mark was living in an apartment that my good friend Eric was moving out of. And so I moved in with Mark and Rick, his other roommate. And Mark, because Mark was living in Hoboken because he went to Stevens, which is in Hoboken. Mm-hmm. So I just like kind of moved in, kept taking classes.
So it wasn't like a giant decision of like, I'm moving to New York, taking classes. It was just like, this is now the next thing I'm doing.
Well, I knew I liked improv, and I took classes at Washington Improv Theater. That was another reason I stayed over the summer, because I was like, oh, I'll take classes while I'm here. I took three of them that spring and then the summer. And I kind of started poking around like who what's the deal in New York City with improv, and at the time it seemed like it was like UCB or Magnet was the places to go, and I couldn't tell from anything the difference. And I had gotten to know Zubin a little bit while I was down there, and he said he was going up to do UCB stuff, so I was like, okay, it kind of ended up being a coin toss in that way. It was like, oh, somebody, one person that I kind of know is going there, so why not?
Again, somebody subtly suggested something to you, and you made a major life decision because of it.
Big time. Yeah, wow. I mean, that's my whole life.
Who was your 101 teacher?
Ari Vukitis.
Right?
Yeah, and we had a good time. And,
anyone still around from that class? It was your Shannon 301 that like was stacked with a lot of people, though, right?
Well, actually, my Shannon 301 looked a lot like my 101.
Oh, great.
Which is part of why. But in my 101, if I'm remembering correctly, Brett White, Katie mm-hmm. Healy-Wurzburg, Jess Wyant, who some people might know.
Mm-hmm. That's all bad data.
That's all bad data, yeah.
It means nothing to the kids listening, but Google it.
Nothing at all. Yeah, Google bad data. Original cast bad data.
Yeah.
And Anna Caligari, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And she kind of disappeared and came back, but we were in that class together. She was still in school at the time. And I'm pretty sure that's everybody who's still around. My apologies if I have forgotten.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Do you feel like in your 101 there was like a sense of, did you hang out with those people? Was there like, because those people ended up being tight. That ended up forming a team.
I think.
Yeah. Wait. How come you weren't on Bad Data?
Yeah, I think because I was kind of half. Like I was like
half.
Like
in
I
it.
Like you know I wasn't like I'm going to UCB. I'm taking improv. Right. I was like I'll go do improv there. And I was really at that time much more focused on my stand up.
Right.
Like
right.
That. Like when I was in New York, I was going to do stand up like multiple times a night.
So when did the shift happen? When did you become like super improv nerd, Matt Mayer?
That's a good question. Man, I wish I'd been paying more attention at the time. Someone probably was just like, do improv instead of stand-up. And mm-hmm. I was like, okay.
Was it that maybe you started to not like stand-up or?
I think I really fell in love with the, I definitely fell in love with the community aspect of, the large community aspect of right. improv that I wasn't getting in stand-up. There right. was a little bit of like, I ran into more people who were doing really well at stand-up, who were kind of aggressive socially, like in a way that was unpleasant, like would try and get me to like, you know, they're like, yeah, this insulting each other is what we do, you know?
Yeah,
and I'd be
know,
like, but it's so much more fun if you insult me and I go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I'm starting to see a like a mental shift. And maybe I was kind of not paying attention to the scene at the time because I think the scene itself has kind of made that shift too.
The stand-up scene.
Yeah, the stand-up scene has made that shift toward being a little bit more let's go along with it as opposed to, you know, the old school, you know, like
pretension,
leather
sort
jacket,
of like hiding
a
your
cigarette
insecurities.
And a whiskey
yeah.
on stage kind of thing. And then I was also like, and this is going to sound stupid, way at the end of my stand-up, I was doing like a lot of object work jokes.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Interesting.
What does that even mean?
Just like act outs. I know what he means.
I would do like more or less silent act outs, and I would sometimes let them go for a long time because yeah. I was one of those weird stand-ups who was like, let's see how we can make it.
There are a ton of comedians that have used sort of some of those improv tools. Like I've seen definitely comedians where all their punchlines are like them acting out as a character.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like they'll be like, yeah, I went to this place and people were like, excuse me. I guess that's a bad example.
That's a terrible example.
Is that Steve
Especially
Urkel?
Because, like, there
that
was
the worst example.
Jaleel White stand-up. That's how he got that
I
show.
I realized as I was doing it, I was like, this is the worst example.
Especially because there was no object
there
work.
There was no object work. No, I realized I couldn't show
could
it to the
it.
Listeners.
Yeah, you could, if the listeners, you could be in the room. He kind of had like...
he was maybe
like
holding a stick.
A sack over his arm. Like maybe he was like at the laundromat and he had just walked in. He was going to do a drop-off or something.
What's the joke? You bumped into someone?
Look, I gave a bad example. Mm-hmm. Some stand-ups do act that. I'm not a stand-up.
But yeah. you gave a bad example after saying like, oh yeah, I've seen this
I know.
Thing.
No, I know.
Here's,
I know.
Here's an example of that
I
time
exactly
I saw Jaleel White
what I did. I know exactly
ben,
what I did.
The Steve Urkel character in front of my eyes.
Yeah, so you were doing object work stand-up.
So I think I can... I remember the two main jokes that the category falls into. It was like, one of them was like, I don't know why people break stuff when they get angry. You know, like I get that it could be cathartic, but it's just as cathartic to pretend to break stuff. And then mm-hmm. I would just
pretend
to break a bunch of stuff.
That's really funny.
And I factored into it like a, you make me mad. Like I'd pick out an audience member and ask them to make me mad.
Well, that's good. I like that.
It was fun.
Was it that improv was starting to influence your stand up and you're like, maybe it's just because I love improv.
I think that was a large part of it. And that was.
Was it also at that point you were getting what you needed from stand up from improv plus?
I think so. I think I was. I mean, to be truthful, I think it was more of a selfish improviser back then.
Mm-hmm.
And there is still a part of me that I think has a little bit of a void where stand-up used to be in the like kind of taking the spotlight thing, because I don't think good improv looks like that. And so I don't get I'll get a similar feeling of just like success and like
yeah.
we're all on stage having a good time getting laughs, but there definitely is it's a difference.
Well, to sidetrack from just sort of the yeah. Matt Mayer story, I think this concept is interesting because stand-ups that end up doing improv, I think we tend to pigeonhole as a certain type of improviser.
Yes.
And when I think about Matt Mayer, the improviser, I would never think this person was a stand-up.
Not at all.
Right?
And I wonder if it's like either... I would describe you as a very principled improviser.
Yeah, I think to a fault.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe. No, for sure.
No, for positive. Like to the point where I'll be boring, I think. From an inside view of what's going
to
on.
To yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I don't never heard anybody say that.
But I think I know what you mean. Like the instinct that a stand-up would have of like, let me take charge in this moment to make the funny joke. I don't think that's something that you're necessarily looking for all the time. Like when it happens, I've seen it for sure.
Well, I think the way you describe that makes me feel like I do think that a good improviser takes charge in that they'll be like, we all have responsibility here, and I don't want to assume that the other person is going to take responsibility for the scene. We're going to share it, but by both going for it. Not in a, like, whoever gets there first way, right. But like a, let's hold this thing up together kind of right. way. But what I do think you don't do is say like, this is mine now.
Yeah.
Right.
Which a stand-up has to do by its nature. As soon as you don't do that, you lose the audience and their attention. And, you know, you might lose it to another audience member. I mean, that the concept of heckling, actually, people think it means like saying bad things or negative things. It just means taking attention at all. So like in that way, the concept is like the stand-up has 100% control.
Right.
And when I do stand-up, I like it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the same art form. You know, so it's like and I think that has to do with being principled. Is like as a stand-up, I was a relatively principled stand-up, not in that I made joke forms perfectly like that. Mm. I was interested in that, and I worked a lot on that kind of stuff. But I also was like, you're trying to engage. You're trying to create a conversation with the audience where they just feel like they're a part of it.
Were these things you were learning in like the 101 through 401, or do you feel like you were still figuring it out? Were you, what I mean is, were you at the time doing stand-up, starting to transition out of stopping doing stand-up, was it because you were embracing these new principles, or is this something that came along a little bit later?
I think the decision had to do with this question that seemed to be posed to me all the time, which was, which one do you really do?
Yeah.
You know, or like this feeling like I had to choose. And I don't think that's true. Definitely.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Maybe it was true-ish at the time, but I think it was going, that concept went out of fashion. But I felt like I had to choose. I was being told a lot by people that I had to choose.
There was a dumb little rivalry. I don't know what it is, but like improvisers don't want to admit that they're stand-ups or vice versa.
Right.
I think part of what it was is that like the stand-ups who would show up in 101 were such jerks. And we wanted, or it could be. No, that's not true. Not that they all were. But like the stand-ups who like you thought of as a stand-up behaved a certain way.
Yeah.
And we're like, we want to believe that we're not that. So if you're going to be one of us, Matt, you got to prove that you're not that.
Well, I think I might have been like that at the beginning, but without kind of knowing it. Like you, the way that you create something funny in stand-up is traditionally different than the way you do it in improv. So I was doing what I knew how to create funny, and I remember being given the note a lot: stop being jokey.
Right.
But I didn't know what that meant. Like I like the word joke to me.
It was like, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
I don't think I knew stand-up well enough to know that joke or improv well enough. Maybe both, to know that there was like a it meant like a turn. You know what I mean? It meant like what they were talking about was like ripping the carpet out from under the scene.
They meant don't be insincere. Don't be.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't be insincere and don't negate or like, you know, find humor by
don't
turning
undercut,
it. Don't undercut.
Yep.
And I didn't know that. And I didn't. And I was never I never took the initiative to ask or thought to ask. Maybe I was scared to ask.
Yeah.
But I was being given the note a lot all the way through 301. And I remember feeling like, okay, if I want to be good at improv, I do have to dedicate myself to it. It is not something that I can just dip my toes in and be great at.
Right.
And I loved it so much. And I remember watching something on stage that I thought was a joke that if you had said that is, and this is such one of those things, we're about to go into this territory of like how much kind of emotional power the artistic director of a theater has over somebody, especially when they're starting out.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember watching something on stage that to me looked like a joke and watching Anthony King laugh his pants off as I laughed too and was like, oh, maybe that's not a joke. And it's just somebody being really funny.
Right.
It was a scene between Emily Axford and Jill Donnelly. And
so this is Ragnarok. Harold Knight.
This might have been their first show. It was
2007?
Yeah, so that would make it like 2007.
Cool.
Ish. Maybe later, if it wasn't their first show. And I can't remember exactly everything was going on in the scene, but basically Emily had come home to find that Jill, who had been kind of house-sitting, had broken a lamp. And Emily made this like cool, subtle observation. Was like, you seem like, and this was several lines into the scene, but and it, so it was kind of like a second observation, a kind of one that mm-hmm. already fit into the category they were working in. And she was like, you seem like you think I should be happy that you only broke my lamp. And Jill goes, she took a second and she goes, well, I have been here all day. And mm-hmm. It was so funny. It was like uproarious laughter of the theater. Anthony King with his
and
classic
in your
laugh.
Head, you're thinking this is
I'm
a
like,
joke.
That's a joke.
All right.
Because that's like, it's a sitcom. Like, you write that line.
Right.
That's
a funny
perfect
line. Right?
Line.
Yeah.
From that character, that line that fits perfectly into that character. I was like, oh, that's not what joke means at all. That's our goal. So I had been, for several classes, working away from that
right.
because of my misunderstanding, as opposed to working towards that. And what I'd been working towards while I was working away from that was all I was thinking about was like building reality
right.
and like all that stuff. So
just
I think it creates
so this misunderstanding. Yeah, this misunderstanding
stuff, yeah.
kind of took you down the right path for a little bit.
Yeah, it took me away from funny. It took yeah. me away from trying to be funny.
It's funny because there's
beneficial.
Lots of times where I wish we would take the focus off of being funny so they could learn those things.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. I think that's very...
I know.
Yeah.
It asks for such a leap of confidence from students, though, because you're like, okay, you're not going to get laughs, and I know that's how yeah. we all reassure each other, but like, let's just make it okay that we don't get laughs, yeah. and I think it's just like can be so hard to be in that room for
it's
a
hard.
Long time.
Yeah. Well, also, a lot of times, like, socially, the way you get a laugh is different
exactly.
than the way you get a laugh when you're playing theater, you
right.
know, because improv is creating... rich right. theatrical mm-hmm. fiction that is funny.
And
right?
I do think part of the reason that we get so obsessed with bits is because we figure out this new way to get laughs socially and mm-hmm. we're addicted to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think addiction.
Because
is a good
like,
word for
yeah.
it.
It's not the same as being like this jokey guy, but like doing bits with each other is this new way of getting laughs where you're like, this is fun. And yeah. when you interact with someone who doesn't understand it, they're like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah. And I think even conversationally, when I brought up a social difference or the difference between socially being funny and being funny on stage, like conversationally, a lot of times you'll laugh to let people know you're kidding or do some sort
right.
of
right.
some sort of wink without winking. Maybe it's not so like
that's
vaudevillian
something you have
cheesy
to get over, yeah.
but it's
yeah.
like I'm gonna put something on this to make you know that I'm saying something that is supposed to be funny so that we don't have a fight.
Yeah.
You know what
right.
I mean? And that is that's the opposite of what you want to do on stage. That is jokiness. Same line with a different tone, you know.
So when did
when did you get good?
Yeah.
You know,
what was the thing that made Matt Mayer world's best quitter not quit? Because you are the opposite of an improv quitter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was pretty close to quitting. I took breaks. I took breaks and came back. I would take like some time between classes at the beginning. I want to say I didn't have a team for a while. And then I was on a team with Rory, and Tim Martin and
Four
Jubin.
Really good friends.
No,
that is...
this was a team that did not last long and had two names and did one show and broke up over just like kind of differences that seemed to be unresolvable.
What are the two names?
The Wonderful Adventure.
Okay.
And, a name that no one ever heard because we didn't do a show under it, but this was like the two names were people were fighting over these two names basically is what happened. Horrors of the Old South.
Wow.
Those are both bad names.
Both very bad names.
That's
Thunderstorm was also in the mix.
So dumb.
So
that's all DC people. So you, even though you're in New York, you're meeting New York people. That first team was you hooking up with DC people.
Yeah, and it was Julie Sharbutt also who Jubin was friends and you know kind of comedy colleagues with from college. So it was the five of us, and they kind of just roped me in. They were like, "Hey, come try a practice with us, and if it goes well, we'll be a team." And this was before, so it wasn't really like building a team. It was just kind of like, "Hey," and it
come
was self directed.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah, yeah.
Jubin directed us. I thought it was we were doing interesting stuff. I wouldn't call it. It wasn't like Heraldy, gamey,
right.
necessarily. But then after an Anthony King, my first 501, which was with Anthony King.
It's Advanced Study Herald for the babies out there.
Yeah, I didn't take that.
You've never taken an Advanced Study Herald?
I have taken Advanced Study Herald, but this was 501.
Well,
I took an
saying.
Advanced Study Herald with Shannon O'Neill,
great.
My second thing with her.
You took whatever. Keep going.
See, this is the problem with this podcast. Is
we know too much about
recording.
Each other.
I know. Yeah.
Yes, Nicole. I took another Shannon class after our Shannon class.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So that first 501, which was with Anthony King, formed a group afterwards called Four Really Good Friends, which was me, Adam Bozarth, Darcy, Eric, and now Cardin, Simon Fillion, and Patrick Clare.
That was your first indie team.
That was
that came before Secret Promise Circle.
You know what? I don't even think it did. Now,
yeah, because no, Four Really Good Friends feels like everyone's second indie team.
Yeah, Secret Promise Circle came first.
Okay, thank you.
But that felt like Four Really Good Friends happened started afterwards, but happened kind of at the same time. And Secret Promise Circle was great, and we had a lot of fun together.
Some names on that team: Abby Jacobson, Alana Glazer,
yeah.
Tim Martin.
Elliot was on that team?
Elliot was.
Holy
yeah.
shit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He ended up leaving because he stopped doing improv.
Right.
Right.
Brian Glidewell.
Second version of the team. Ben Levin and Matt Burnett, who right. moved to LA. They stopped doing improv first and then moved to LA. But they're writing.
But
for
I mean, talk about
Cartoon Network shows.
Talk about a first indie team where you're like, well, I wonder where these people will be in
yeah,
a few
right?
years.
Yeah, Tony Rodriguez. Yeah. Also,
all amazing yeah. improvisers.
So it was a great team, and I loved that team. I guess I bring up Four Really Good Friends because that was the first time it was like in a class, and you all just lasered in on each other,
right?
And that's a big confidence booster.
Always,
you know,
think,
like
yeah,
it was like I knew Tim, and Tim was like bringing me onto teams, and that's a cool, awesome thing for Tim
and,
to
and
do.
That's as much a confidence booster as seeing the class get formed out of your indie team that you don't get asked to join.
Yeah,
that can kind of be a bummer, and I yeah. think that's happened to a lot of us.
Yeah, and I there
Never
were other...
happened addressable, but has happened
oh, well,
to me.
No,
has probably
not.
Happened to me.
Actually, that's not true, Daddy. But keep going.
Yeah.
Well, that was not your fault. The, you know. I think we would have brought you on.
We'll get to Daddy.
Let's continue.
So there was something like Secret Promise Circle, like I said, was doing like great shows, having fun, practicing regularly. We were working with Bobby Moynihan, having a great time. And that is some of the best improv that I've done. But there is something about like you being in a class and being like, I really like the way you improvise, and having that person basically say that
yeah.
back by you all forming a team together. And that was the first time that really happened.
Yeah. Okay. So there's so much stuff that we want to talk to you about. So I don't want to spend too much more time on backstory.
Okay.
I do want to get to, and this is like selfish because I was there for it.
Of course.
But
yeah.
Dave Murray texted in a question, which was ask Matt about Organic Heralds. And I was like, maybe who cares? I was like, what team did Matt ever do Organic Heralds with?
Oh, the
and
one that you were
just,
in a class
yeah,
with watching every week.
The one. Yeah. So let's talk about what Daddy was. Because I think that's like, I, as an old timer, I'm sad that like so many students never got to see Daddy and don't know what that was.
Yeah.
So talk about it.
Cool. Well, thank you. I really loved that team. That was so Shannon, if you're listening, if I got any of this wrong, I apologize. But as far as I know, Shannon was playing around with the idea of doing Organic Heralds classes. And this is Shannon O'Neill I'm talking about. And this was back when everything was still 8 weeks, except the occasional workshop,
right.
Or maybe like four. I think Gethard was still doing his 4 week things at the time, starting doing that. But signed up for another 501 with Shannon. And Shannon was doing this. The reason I signed up for this class, because truth be told, Shannon was one of the teachers who had been telling me I was jokey. So I didn't get her that well in 301. But I really loved this idea because I was just starting to understand the concept of team chemistry. Because now when you're on multiple teams, you start to realize, oh, you play differently when you're on different teams, at least slightly, especially at the beginning, because you're kind of figuring it out. And Shannon was doing that. She was like first or second class, splitting her class up into two teams of eight. What?
Nope, keep going.
And she was doing that previously. And so I was like, that sounds awesome. I'm going to take a class where that happens because, like, it seems great to just try and build chemistry over
yeah,
8 weeks.
Teach
with the
you
same
how to be
people.
On a team, for sure.
So, so we get into that class, and right away, it's a great group of people, super, super fun. And Shannon splits the class, I think, at the half of the first
she
class.
She did, yeah. She yeah. left. She was like, I might be able to do this already. She left and came back, and she was like, here's your teams.
Yeah. And so Nicole was in that class, but not on the team. The team was me, Ashley Hale, who's in LA now, Dan Klein, also in LA now, but was on The Law Firm while I was here, many Herald teams, Zubin Parang, Jeremy Bent, Paul Welsh, Brett White, where am I in this list?
Amy.
Amy Whitehouse, is that everybody?
I think so.
And me. Yeah, so it was like, basically it was split up into what seemed like the listeners and the really, really aggressive people.
Right.
And we were the really, really aggressive people.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I felt a little bit alien on that team, but I think when Shannon had known me, I was really aggressive.
Right. So she thought that you would fit in on this.
Yeah, and what kind of, you know, what, like, to jump ahead in the story before I go back a little bit is like, it made me be more aggressive, which was really a positive thing for me at that time, because I had been really struggling with making huge choices now that I'd been obsessed with not being jokey. So then Nicole was on the other team, and there were a lot of really great people on that team too, including Christopher Scott.
Yeah, you got a long-running indie team that changed your lives, but I got a fucking boyfriend.
So true.
I think I'd pick that.
Yeah, this is gross.
This is Sean's nightmare. I don't care.
Full-on nightmare.
Yeah. I won because daddy's not together anymore.
That's not true. I met my wife many years earlier.
I just want to say clearly so that everyone hears it. I won because daddy's not together anymore.
Okay.
That is true.
Wow.
It's also the class where Nicole and I met and became friends.
And got in a fight.
We got in a fight?
Do you remember the fight?
I don't remember the fight.
Okay, we're not going to talk about it on air.
Oh, man. We'll have to. Well, we kind of have to now. But
do you remember we were friends? We were friends. We'd hang out a lot. It would be you, me, and Chris Scott at the bar.
Yep.
And eventually you knew you were supposed to leave.
Yeah.
And there was you and I were in a competition for who could see the most shows.
Uh-huh.
Are you starting to remember this?
No.
Oh, my God, Matt. We, like, were just, like, new friends, but, like, really liked each other a lot.
Yeah, very quickly.
Oh, my God. We were in a competition for who would see the most shows. And the last week, you just edged me out on
who had seen
the most shows. But I was like, I don't think Matt should count. He's seeing them while he's interning at Herald Night, so he's working at the same time. And you gave me a dressing down. You talked to me about how I think you were like, not cool, man. I don't remember what you said.
Was it in class at, like, in front of everybody?
No, it was after.
Oh,
you were
nice.
Like really upset at me for the fact that I had impugned your honor by suggesting that you had not really seen the shows that you were asking for credit to see.
I think I might have even told you, because I remember doing this at the time, like, I would say, hey, Chuck, I'm going to watch this show now.
Maybe.
Like, if you need me, cool, but I'm going to watch this show.
I thought we were having a friendly, jokey competition, and you principled
Matt
Mayer.
Great.
You were so upset.
Here's what's great. This is very, like, this is very foundational for our relationship.
Yes, because we
call each other.
Scared of you. What?
We just call each other on our shit. That's, like, a big part of what we do. I don't know
who was calling who on what.
Fair.
Well,
we worked it out, apparently.
Sean hates this.
Sean's like, why are you guys telling stories?
Sean said to me, Sean, right before we went in, Sean was like, we got to be careful. We can't make it about us.
We can't make this about us.
True.
And I was like, okay, Sean.
So good side story.
Okay, so Daddy. Where'd Daddy's name come from?
Where did Daddy's name? Well, just real quick before I get to that. So something kind of fun about this class was that Shannon had no intention, I think, of making it the organic Herald class. So to help answer Dave Murray's question, she then was like, I think you guys can handle it, the 16-person group, and we're just going to go full into it. And we did, and it was really like an incredibly formative class, probably the most formative class that I even still have taken. I'd say that the thing that I learned most about it was when you really have a game, you don't have to worry about the setting. And I say that because we would do transitional edits. And that word is not fair. It's kind of like used in multiple places. It's not a good word, I think. But yeah, we would flock and do sound
fluid,
and movement-y stuff
sort of,
and like go from one thing. And then by the time you were in a new scene, in the order of the show, out there with your scene partner from the previous beat, from the first beats, you had to figure out what the location was before you brought the game back into it, and you'd have to find a way to bring the game back into it.
You basically get dropped into a second beat.
Yeah, and you could always do it. That was the beauty of it. If you had a good game, you could always do it.
And this is definitely the Fwand influence, right?
Yes,
Shannon
heavily.
Teaching.
Big time.
I mean, when I saw Daddy, I remember thinking this is what Fwand was probably like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, there aren't very, very many people doing this. Not very many people can do this. And you're right, Nicole, like this generation, I don't know if we've seen anything close. There are teams that do stuff like that with maybe like women and men right now. I've seen some organic stuff, but this like dropping into second beats and continuing to be organic through every single scene is a little bit lost on this generation.
I think so.
And yeah. I remember I was, you know, a generation under you, and I saw, a memory I actually have was I was in the training center and you guys were in that class and your entire team left the room.
Uh-huh.
And I remember Dan Klein was like sitting at the door, like listening.
I know exactly what this is.
Because yeah. It was something about maybe you guys were old people doing a Herald or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was the That's last
the
class.
Nursing home Herald.
Yeah, it was the last class, and she had assigned each of us a kind of kind of people to be doing a Herald, mm-hmm. and we'd contextualize it as a part of the Herald. And she gave us, we were people's grandmothers and grandfathers at a nursing home about to do a Herald for their families.
Yeah. It's just one of those
things.
So
we left it to get into character.
I remember that moment.
And you guys did Orphans.
Orphans for an audience of prospective parents.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which is probably how I do every show.
It's so funny because I remember that moment and I remember that team and I do, this was when I was getting to know you and I do remember this feeling like a important team. And I think, didn't you guys start hosting Wednesdays with Herald at the
Holy
Creek?
Holy shit, yeah.
Yeah.
So you guys were doing Heralds. You kept doing Heralds after this class.
So the class goes great. We have super, super fun. We were doing two class shows. So we did the first class show and then the second class show. Shannon, just to answer your question about the name, Shannon says, okay, pick a representative from each of your team. We picked Ashley. I can't remember who you guys picked. But then she was like, okay, you guys do rock, paper, scissor. And whoever wins gets to name the other team for when I announce you guys at this one show. And
I don't think that's
at
true,
our class show.
What? I think you guys, you won environmental charades during the last class.
What?
That's why. You won environmental charades
I
during the last class.
I could swear there was a rock, paper, scissors.
You won environmental. Yeah.
Guys, eyewitness accounts of anything, don't trust them.
Wow. It's like callback to something before.
Yes. So we won whatever it was.
Yep.
And we were given the opportunity to name the other team. And we had basically we spent our whole warm-up discussing how to do this. And we were trying to come up with a good team name for the other team to be nice.
Yeah.
And
right.
Then somebody
is,
said,
because
like,
you guys were, the cool kids and we were the listeners. Like, you described it yourself. Again, like, I have a boyfriend. But you guys were the cool ones, and we were, like, your friends who were not on the cool teams.
And we were trying to be the jock who's friendly.
Yeah.
And we should have just been the jocks.
You eventually did.
Yeah. So basically what had happened was, while we were walking off stage, after Shannon was like, okay, you guys get to name them. This is before all the discussion. Paul Welsh said under his breath, "Daddy's a little cum dumpster." And then we decided it would not be really truly honoring. Like, yes, it's nicer to give them a cool name, but it would not be truly honoring what Shannon was trying to do to give the other team a nice name. We should give them the worst fucking name we could think of. And then somebody brought that up again, that Paul had said that under his breath. And we were like, yep, that's it. And then we were like, what are we? And somebody said something like, Daddy's Little Princess. And then I think Dan Klein goes, no, Daddy.
Gross.
Wow. So your daddy. And she Shannon announced, and Daddy's Little Cum Dumpster went first.
Yep.
And then we went second, and it was
and
a
then
funny
you
joke.
Became daddy based on the bullying of the other team.
Yeah. I mean, every time you were introduced, it was a knife in the heart again.
Oh man.
It's very interesting. So you kept doing Heralds with this team.
So we decided to stay on as an indie team because we just had so much fun together. We decided to be unchanged. Shannon coached us for a little bit.
Right.
And we did, we and three other teams.
It was Zuleika, Froduce.
Yep.
And
Fritz?
Yeah, Froduce and the Fritz. Right. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And basically what had happened was we had the same idea as Froduce and the Fritz. We and Zuleika had the same idea as Froduce and the Fritz. Basically, a bunch of teams had the same idea at the same time.
Because this was, I think, coming off of a bunch of people not getting on Herald Night. It was like one
right.
of those, like...
Oh, okay.
After
yeah.
auditions, oh fuck, we didn't get on. What the fuck are we doing
it
with our lives?
It might have also
we're
been 10 teams. So people were like, fuck, there's
it was the year
be...
of 10 teams. Yeah, because it was Robber Baron and Robber Baron and the Bishop.
Okay.
Were put together. So it was like 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people were like, I want to keep doing this. Where do I do it? How do I do it? How do I keep getting better at
and
it?
There was
and
a
the
sense
Creek
of
was
like,
still pretty new.
Yeah, the Creek was pretty new. It was kind of like becoming a place that you'd want to do shows at. People, you could like kind of just throw up a show and count on people being there.
Yeah.
To some extent. And I know that Zuleika was formed with the intent of getting better at Harold's.
Yeah.
And Daddy was basically like, we know we're good at this. Let's keep doing this. So we ended up pairing off, and like every other week it would be us, and then the other weeks it would be Fritz and Frodus, and we would host Wednesdays with Harold. And what we would do is Wednesdays with Harold would be a show of three Harolds, and it would be a guest team and Daddy and Zuleika. And sometimes later in the run, it was basically just Daddy and Zuleika, like two people from each team would show up. It was always me and Sydney Hollis from Zuleika.
I forget Sydney was on Zuleika.
Yeah. And then we did a lot of shows as Zoo Daddy, as we called it.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of those
and
shows.
And two guest teams.
And I remember they were like interesting.
We did a jam team. Yeah, they were fun shows. Yeah. That was like a great, we had so much, we had a lot of fun doing that. But we did that for like almost a year.
And I think what was interesting about that was that you guys were doing Harold's, but you also had no... like no one was monitoring you guys.
No.
And for a team that did organic Harolds and with people like Dan Klein and Jeremy Bentz, like I saw some really crazy shit. I think I saw one where someone went up in the booth for the whole show and someone was in the tech booth yelling. I mean, multiple going out into the audiences.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, for sure.
I don't even know if you guys took suggestions all the time.
I don't know either.
Like this was where I think it was at this point in my career. It was seeing Daddy and maybe seeing some other things. I remember being like, wow, you could really push the envelope.
Yeah, there was a lot of fun stuff. We would do very fun stuff. We'd go too meta a lot of the times.
I mean, that was...
I remember, I was just going to say before, like, I remember Amy Whitehouse going out into the audience and yelling, why isn't this the Stepfathers?
I honestly feel like I learned how to be meta from watching that team.
Because it would go somewhere. It wasn't meta just to be meta. It was meta because you were straining against something.
And people like Jubin and Dan Klein were just,
Jubin would love to go meta, but he would know, like, we'll find something really fun and exciting and we won't just be commenting on the show. And that was the key, was like, you have to just keep... It's the same thing. It's like being meta is not a game. Like you have to push past that to find your game.
Right.
And we would generally try to do that and do that with you know, some level of success. But another big part of it was a very physical team. And like
totally
to go back to Dave Murray's question, what about organics? Like I think this is just one team. So my experience on that team maybe doesn't translate to all organics teams, but it was a group of people who had decided organically as a team, we're going to make huge choices individually, but then seven people are going to back us up as big as we made it, if not bigger.
Yeah.
And somebody who set the precedent for that, for making big physical choices, for example, was Ashley Hale.
Yeah.
I want to say in the first show, maybe it was in that second show, but in one of our class shows, I think Dan Klein fake punched her in our organic opening. And she hit the deck so hard that Dan later said he thought he had hit her.
Oh, man.
She went down so, she was like a good, she was like an actress with training and did like a pratfall and like nailed the ground so hard. We all were scared for a second, realized she was fine, and then started falling and hitting the ground. But when you have at least a couple people on the team making huge moves, and you know, because Shannon is like cracking the whip on it in the best way, like you have to support that move as hard and far as you can go with it. We would do that, and that's how you get through the like ceiling of the unexpected.
Yeah.
Is by
everyone committing.
I
run into this a lot. Even when you try to teach Follow the Follower for the first time, you realize how much people have to get over to be able to commit 100% physically.
Yeah.
Without knowing what the result's going to be, and there was a level of commitment at that time that is somewhat unrivaled. Like, we commit really hard now. I definitely think that. But there was a physicality to this kind of commitment where I was constantly worried about people being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
people did get hurt, some people.
Once watched you very, very, very accurately insert Jeremy Bent's penis.
Oh, yeah, okay. Great. I want to say...
Well, Jeremy Bent, the actor, his character's penis,
right?
My character.
This is the most disgusting object work I've ever seen.
Yeah, were you at that show?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh God,
I'll never forget it.
Climbed onto his lap.
When I talk about object work, and if I could describe this again, Matt Mayer is a the game is that Jubin's character has brought porn stars to teach his kids about the birds and the bees, and Jeremy Bent is the man, and he's sitting on a chair, and Matt Mayer kind of straddles him, and I could only describe this as reaching back to
guide
the penis into Matt's vagina as he sits down on Jeremy. This is the most vulgar thing we'll ever say, but I watched it and was viscerally disgusted by
it. Oh, man. It got a big groan.
I think it got a big laugh, actually. Yeah. It got a big laugh.
I think maybe both.
I watched it, and this is not in character for me at all, but I remember admiring it.
Yeah. I know. I still bring it up as far as like being specific with object work and how it can really add a new layer to your scene. It affected me.
I remember thinking like, oh, yeah, Matt's different on this team.
It's very true.
Like,
it's
in the
very
best
true.
Way.
Even to, you know, not to change the subject or anything because I'm embarrassed. No, that team, so aggressive that, like, and I don't think this is necessarily good practice on any team, but, like, Jubin initiated, I want to talk to you about the birds and the bees. And I think after that line, I did a walk-on to make the porn stars.
Right.
Like, that's something I would never do on most teams.
Yeah.
But I knew with that team that, well, first of all, we weren't coming with premise off the opening.
Right.
So that's a big part of it. But also that with that team, Jubin was like going to go with it 100%.
Yeah.
I just opened the door and said, are you ready for us? And took a robe off or something like that. And he goes, oh, I've brought these porn stars to show you. Like, it was like seamless.
To the point where I think about it as Jubin's idea, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Let's jump ahead just a little bit.
I do, yeah.
Getting on Herald Night.
Monstro.
Let's talk about that experience, because we like to talk about people's first team and what that was like.
Mm-hmm.
What was Monstro like? I was living with you at the time, so I have a general idea, but
I'd be interested to know what Monstro was like from that perspective. Let's probably know what this is about.
Yeah.
I'll ask you afterwards. The Monstro was a team who...
Monstro, getting on the team, you go into the audition. Did you think you were going to get on? Was this a time where you were very confident going in?
No, I wasn't going to do it at all.
You're right. I remember this.
I was about done.
I think at this point we were living on 70th Street, me and Matt.
No, we were in the Astoria apartment by then. I think so, yeah.
I don't think we were.
I think you're right.
This is the best.
He's right.
I say that because I remember the conversation I had with the DERF where she convinced me to do the audition.
Yes, you're right.
So obviously now, so basically what happened was
Matt had become more on the brig now.
Right. So I just a couple months before had gotten on to the inaugural UCB beta teams, which are now
digital teams.
Yeah, it's a different format, but yes, back then they had beta teams, and I was making videos, and I felt good about that. And I had, you know, I mean, there's this thing, you want to be a part officially of this culture more than just taking a class, and I had wanted that really, really badly, and I did feel like I had gotten that, and I wasn't feeling super great about my improv at the time. And I had done 4 or 5 auditions. I'd never gotten a call back. And I was like, it was on the day of a friend of mine's wedding was the auditions. And I would have had to do it really in the morning. And I was like, I'm not going to do a good audition at like 10 in the morning when I'm not feeling good about my improv. And I got to think about like how fast I can get in a car and drive across the state. And Sarah, my wife...
the DERF we've been referring to earlier.
We've been referring to her as, yeah. I remember sitting at that glass table in the kitchen, and she's like, you have to go, you have to do it, you're going to beat yourself up if you don't do it. And she also said, and this part I wouldn't let in, but she was like, you're hot right now, like you just got on a team there, like your name's in the ether. I don't know if that means anything, but she was like, I think it's a thing, I think it's like perfect timing, and you're going to get on.
Right.
So I was like, I'm just going to do it so that I don't regret it, because I think you're right about that part of it.
So once again, somebody else told you.
Matt Mayer, wow, we're
finding
a real...
Oh, man, I would have quit
many times.
Basically improv, yeah.
It's so funny.
Oh, my God, it's just the truest truth about me. And she... So I do it, and I feel okay about the first audition. It was one of those ones where I did a scene that was very, very real but didn't have a lot of funny in it. And I did another scene where there was a lot of I think it was with Jason Sines was this other scene. And it was – we came in swinging hard and it was a little nuts. And we both spent the rest of the time wrangling, trying to take this huge idea. We were like at a baseball stadium in the seats but not sitting down. It was like kind
of
nuts.
Yeah, one of those scenes where we're trying to do too much.
And I think we did a good enough job of wrangling, basically. Like by the end of it, it made sense.
Yeah.
Good for us. Right. And, so I got a call back and truthfully, like after the call, I went into the callback with a thought. I was like, look, Matt, you don't feel great about your improv right now. What does that mean? You don't really feel great about your scene work. I felt like I wasn't doing great two-person scene work. So I was like, this was the first audition, I think, in a while where they were doing non-four scene Harolds, right? Weren't they doing for a while?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought they did that. Maybe I was wrong.
My audition the year before definitely was regular.
Maybe that
Harold.
Was the first one or something.
Maybe.
But anyway, so I was like, they're just going to do a Harold. There's going to be eight people in there, and probably people are going to be trying really hard to get into a scene.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I was like, don't worry about that. If there's a half-second gap, go for it so that the show moves smoothly. So don't hesitate, but don't be a person who's aggressively going for it. So I ended up being a swing player. I ended up playing one of the other two roles, starting a group game, doing some walk-ons, that kind of thing.
Nowadays people try to be that person because they've heard of so many people getting on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think is risky.
I think it's risky. I think
it's a little cowardly.
Yeah, I think maybe it was definitely cowardly for me, but at the same time, you could say I was playing to my strengths, which I thought I was.
Right.
I was like not a huge character guy. I would play aggressive if the other person would. I kind of would like let someone take the lead even if I initiated. So I was like, I'm feeling good about coming in and supporting, and I'll just do that. So I did that, and I felt really good about it. I felt really good about it.
I remember you thinking you got on a team afterwards.
Yeah, I called Sarah and I was like, I think I might have just got on a Harold team.
Holy crap. And
the Harold was not great.
Yeah.
And there were some great people in there. It was me, Jesse Lee, mm-hmm. Sashir, Arthur Meyer.
Yeah.
Rob Stern.
Great people.
Marie Ladigan, Don Luby. I mean, it was like a good group of people who just couldn't put together a great Harold. But I felt good about
Dan Black in there, did you?
Ooh, was Dan Black? I don't think so.
Okay.
But and this is a complex thing about improv, mm-hmm. is like feeling good about individual performance but not necessarily
versus
about a show or vice versa. But that was one of those cases where I felt like I was coming in at the right time. I wasn't bullying. I was supporting in a way where like if something was not going great, I would say it doesn't matter if it's not going great. It's still truthful and do that kind of thing. And it was it felt pretty good.
This comes up a lot, and I think when people go into auditions, they're always like, what can I do? What's the secret to auditions? And the thing that I think is a little bit of a trend that I've noticed is that the less you care about the audition, the better you'll do.
Well, that's something
can
that people
I adjust
say a lot
that?
About everything.
I don't think it's the less you care. I think it's the less you're worried,
right.
Maybe.
Caring
I think some personalities need to go extreme and not give a shit.
Right.
It's like find that middle ground where you care, but you're not worried. Like you haven't misunderstood the consequences of this Harold.
I just remember the feeling of when I was living with Matt, he didn't give a shit about improv at that time.
Yeah, I think that's,
And he was basically like, I'm going to do this audition. If it goes well, whatever. And because he had that mentality, it allowed him to access the actual way he improvises.
Right.
Where if you put any sort of pressure on yourself. I mean, you play differently with the pressure, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The people who can go into auditions and just blow people away are the ones who can care less or figure out ways to find that middle ground.
They don't care what the other person wants to see. They don't care what the auditors are looking for.
Right.
They're just like, I'm going to do me. Like that. Basically what happens is you take off the affectation of trying to give the other person what they want.
Totally.
Yes.
And maybe you do give the other person exactly what they want. You might give the other person exactly what they want, but only because that's what you've been doing.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
And that's what you've been practicing.
And, you know, not to speak for Dan Black, but I know that he was very purposely, he was like, I'm going to work the hardest I could possibly work. And he cared about it so much. But that worked for him because he was able to push through.
He's the type of person, that could live up to those. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It does come down to to the type of person, but I see a lot of people going into auditions, and being able to watch auditions for the first time this year, I could see the people that were putting too much pressure on themselves, mm-hmm. and the people who were like, well, you know, whatever happens, happens,
right.
ended up being able to access their kind of true improviser selves.
Yes. And to take it out of the audition context, I think that can often be true on stage.
Oh, totally.
If not 100% of the time, is like, you're like, you know, maybe you have like a personal goal that you want to achieve. Like, oh, I haven't been playing characters at all.
Right.
So let me, like, even though it might not be necessary, let me play a character in this show. Outside of those kinds of things, if you just go in it being like, I improvise. It's what I do. I don't need to, like, this doesn't have to be the best show in the history of the world. And I don't have have to have my best contribution in the history of the world for it to be okay.
I think also sort of related, sometimes you watch people who are so good on stage or so good at improv, and then they can't do scripted work, or and then they can't do camera work. And I think it's because, like, you've gotten used to ignoring the audience, so you just do you, but you haven't yet gotten used to ignoring the camera in the same way. So even though it's the exact same skill, it's totally the same skill set.
I've had to get over that. That's totally right. Like, commercial auditions is another thing. You have to learn how to get over that.
You have,
learn how to be on camera and kind of not put the pressure on yourself. It's totally all universal, I think.
Yeah, and that's why even though it's the same skill set, it sometimes doesn't... is not as easy to do in that other context.
It maybe helps you along the way if you had no experience at all in
100%.
But you do have to adjust it.
So let's talk about Monstro. You get on Monstro after this team.
How did you feel when you saw the lineup of that team?
I didn't know exactly what to feel, truthfully. I know that it's a great team and I love it. I mean, I have such a close, weird personal relationship now with every single one of those people. It's pathetic.
You want to list them? Sarah Claspel, Matt Mayer, Jesse Lee, Matt Cutler, Dan Black, Frank Hell, and
Paul Welsh
and Beth Appel.
I mean, it was stat. Like, you looked at that lineup at the time, and you're like, "Oh, that's all like that's first. That's all the like duh kids. Like that's all the people that
should
for years everyone
yeah,
had been saying, why aren't these people on?" And it was also like therefore the cool kids.
Right. Yeah, which I don't know if that did us any favors.
It definitely did not.
But when I saw the lineup, I was like, well, I loved playing with Paul. Paul and I have been playing on Daddy for a long time, and we really enjoyed doing scenes together, so that's always positive. And Paul is, if you don't know Paul Welsh, he is just one of the naturally funniest people to ever
meet. Yeah, maybe the best second line man of all time, right?
What was Paul's personal note in that Shannon 501?
Oh, Paul's personal note was, and I'm somewhat paraphrasing, but maybe saying it verbatim, was like, be less funny.
Yeah, that was it. That was his personal challenge note in 501. Not be less jokey.
Yeah.
Paul, be less funny.
And then she expounded on it by saying, like, so sometimes in a scene, like, the other character will be the unusual one, but that doesn't mean they have to get all the laughs, but, you know, focus should maybe be on them, and you're so funny that you take focus. Can we try and, like, have you be less funny so you don't take so much focus? And then we did an exercise, and it just didn't work, and she actually said, forget it.
I mean, it was, like, a great attempt, but it was like, you can't help it.
Yeah. So you see this joyous
and like fun and he's great to play with.
So you see this lineup, you love Paul.
I love Paul. I don't know much about Cutler, but I really admire him because he had been doing Oscar Bait, which I thought was really great. And I'd watched them perform non-movie. The Oscar Bait was a movie team formed out of a 600 now ASP type thing, which sought the movie. And they were doing non-movie stuff as Merv Byrne. And they were doing some of the funniest shows I'd ever seen. So I really, like, I knew and liked Cutler. Claspel and I had been in classes together, and I knew and liked her a lot. Beth Appel, I had a personal relationship with her where I was like, I remember reaching out to her being like, I don't know what's going on, but you have turned a corner. You're, like, killing it right now. And we had this conversation that maybe is relevant to the podcast about, like, the three-year mark. We were like, there's something about hitting 3 years that felt like you soaked something in fast, you know, like the curve went up. You broke through a plateau, maybe is what it was, around 3 years that you had kind of hit. And because she was doing some movie stuff that was super, super funny. I was seeing her around. And I didn't really know Jesse very well. I think I'd seen her perform one time. And then Dan, like, I had not seen him much, but you know, one of those things where, like, you know somebody who is a lot like you. Like, we have similar, like, histories, yeah. I guess.
We're both aggressive kinda Jewish dudes from Jersey.
Who people think are Italian. And like his friends like reminded me of people from my I had this secret, he had no idea about it. But like I was like, I don't know about this guy. Which is not a good way to be about anything, but that's the truth. And then did I go through everybody? And then Jeremy, I had done a lot of stuff with Jeremy also. Or no, did I say Jeremy?
He was said Jeremy, but team. You mean Frank.
I mean Frank. Frank, I also didn't really know that well. Yeah. But I'd known him as like, he kind of just skyrocketed. He like showed up one day and was just like killing it.
Right.
I said Jeremy because of Very Good Kiss in the Future. But I was like, okay, I don't know. But what was true about that team immediately was like, everybody was like, let's do the best improv in the world.
Well, like, I think this is that first team syndrome is like, yeah. Everyone is so juiced up. That I know many stories about Monstro, but you end up aggressively pushing yourself into conflict by just being overly opinionative and overly like, this needs to be the song and this needs to be the name.
And I was very guilty of all of that.
God, I wasn't going to ask you to talk about song, but yeah, keep going.
There was an argument over song. Matt doesn't have to go into it. I remember experiencing it. But there was like times where,
we should now, because now it just is
well,
like.
Well, this is from my perspective. There were times where I would see things happening, and even in you, Matt, I would see things happening where I'd be like, "Oh, this isn't a good idea."
No, man, I know that, there was a lot of I was Bad News Bears for a while. I was very aggressive. I think I might have earned a reputation as being very aggressive and opinionated. And there was an aspect of it that was like a little bit holier than thou, which is not a good way to be. There was like a million things that I wish that I would have done differently because of my own bad behavior. I don't like the way things have turned out, but I feel like I could have been a nicer, better person.
Well, the thing on these teams, too, is that you're not the only one going through that. Everyone is kind of having that.
Right.
And from my experience, I got on a team where I was the only one kind of freaking out in this way.
Uh-huh.
So it was very pronounced.
The only, like, brand new.
But on these brand new teams, you see it all the time. You know, there's that anniversary period, and as soon as that's over.
Do you mean honeymoon?
Honeymoon period.
Yes.
The honeymoon period's over. And then it becomes like the reality sets in, and everyone kind of is continuing on this, like, I don't know, you set yourself on a path for like, confrontation.
Yeah, or like just at least conflicting intensities.
Right.
Well, what happens is...
Then your shows end up not... For almost every new team, your shows end up not going that well. So now you've got intensity and panic.
Right. Yeah,
and now the back hallway at UCB on Tuesday nights is a fucking nightmare.
In a way, if the shows were good, maybe some of that stuff goes away.
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think it's a coincidence that Sandino was long running, also a team that people were really happy to be on, and was good out the gate.
Right. Yeah.
Like, who knows?
And
like,
certainly
they're
as
all great
intense
people.
As anybody else.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Book
totally
club, they were
intense.
Practicing probably just as much as us.
But if you're being rewarded for that intensity, it's easier to then like bottle
Not
it and channel it
other,
and make
yeah.
it productive. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were doing the kind of thing, and I say we, and I don't mean they, I mean me. And maybe some other people, regardless. I'm trying to make sure you know I mean me.
Oh, I will let everyone know because I saw it firsthand.
We were doing things like passive aggressively noting each other in practice. I mean, it got like when you're really, really intense and you say a strong opinion instead of just being like, I trust you, I trust the other people on this team and I trust the coach. If it's really an issue, then it'll just get dealt with. Or if the coach thinks that there's something more important to deal with. I mean, at a certain point, by being incredibly opinionated and vocal, you're undermining the coach, not just, you know, creating conflict on your team.
And you say things like, we got to stop doing walk-ons and first beats. But you didn't walk on to a first beat.
Exactly.
And you don't mean me.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just my example,
no,
Sean.
No, I'm with you. No, like, I've been there. I mean, I've done those same things.
And you never mean we. You always mean you fuckers.
Yeah. When you say that, you never have a problem with somebody doing the kind of thing you would do.
Yeah,
so
right.
So you're not bringing up stuff that, you're not bringing up your own thing. Sometimes that would happen. I think good, honest, nice people would do that kind of thing.
But then you always say, and and I mean me.
Right.
When it doesn't come with the, like you just did just now, when it doesn't come with the and I mean me, then the implied is, and I don't mean me when I say we.
If there's no example attached to it, they probably mean somebody other than themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I feel like this is a lot of people's experience on their first team.
Yeah.
And it's not.
But we did like 5 hours of practice a week. We did a 3 hour and a 2 hour.
Wow.
We would make sure that that 3 hour was with the same person, then most of the time was with the same person, but we'd also throw in workshops. I mean, sometimes we'd throw in workshops in addition to the three and the two.
Yeah, you guys were fucking going hard.
Two shows a month because
you were fifth slot.
We were fifth slot. Like, we started, I think we did only our first show not in the fifth slot, and then we were fifth slot the whole time. Back then, you would basically, for lack of a better word, you'd be punished for not doing great work.
There was one Herald night, five teams a night, and if the anchor slot was the fourth team, and the team that was not doing the best would...
It would be two teams.
Two teams would get two shows a month, and they were the anchor slot. They were the five slot.
And then the four slot was...
Or the one was also the punishment slot, but it was not as... It didn't hurt as much.
Right.
And then the anchor team would have... Four shows a month as opposed to just two.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was three.
I think anchor team would have four, and then like most teams would have three, and punished teams would have two.
Yeah. So we basically, our shows were given to.
Yeah, I remember standing backstage with Cutler right before a Dybbuk show, and Dybbuk was the team that he moved to after Monster was broken up, and we were in a fifth slot, and Cutler was like, "I don't know, guys. I mean, I liked the fifth slot. Monster had some of our best shows in the fifth slot," and I turned to him and I went, "Cutler, Monster had all your shows in the fifth slot."
It was true. As far as I remember, we never got out of it. Mm-hmm. And it started to wear on us. And I don't think that that system is a... I truthfully don't think that that system is necessarily a bad system. I think we didn't handle it well.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is not saying... those are two different things.
It's not an easy system.
It's not an easy system. But
it's hard to get better when you're doing
it. I'm one of those people who... And I'll say it all the time, but it's like, it's not supposed to be an easy system.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, it's supposed to be a system that promotes creativity, and sometimes the difficulty of it can stifle to an extent. But I mean, we're talking about doing improv on a flagship show, basically a flagship show that's been running for 15 years at maybe the most important improv theater in the country. Therefore, sorry, Britain, the world, and so it's like, yeah, I think the expectation should be pretty high.
Okay, so we can't go through all of it step by step.
Yes.
But you've been now, I mean, you're old man Harold Knight right now.
Yeah, I think so.
You've been on seven teams.
Seven.
You're definitely the most veteran of anybody on right now, even with being cut.
Were you cut from Monstro?
No.
I was cut from CAPTCHA. CAPTCHA was
broken
reassembled,
up.
Yeah. Broken up. Right. Five people, three of us
CAPTCHA
were cut.
CAPTCHA and Dybbuk basically became Dance Break, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right. Wait. No.
No? Yeah.
Phil Jackson from Grandma's Ashes, so that's six. Five people from CAPTCHA, Phil Jackson, Nicole Byne?
I don't think she was on the original Dance Break lineup.
Oh, okay. She came later. So maybe.
All right. Dance Break was Frank Hell, Langan Kingsley, Connor
Ratliff. Talking about Dance Break.
Yeah, you're right. Why are we doing this?
I don't
know. We're cutting ourselves is what we're doing right now.
Right. We're cutting ourselves.
Anyway.
But yeah, I got cut.
For a hot second, though.
Yeah, basically during the switchover between Anthony King and Nate Dern.
Yeah.
That's right. Nicole wasn't original because I now work with Nate Dern, who was becoming AD in the time when I was cut. And I asked him, I was like, was I your first official decision as artistic director to bring me back on Herald Knight? And
he was Nicole like, to Standard Oil.
And he was like, actually, you were, because Nicole... was Anthony King called Nate Dern up, was like, there's this spot on Herald Knight, and I've been wanting to put Nicole on Herald Knight for a long time. Can you say okay to that? And so him saying okay to that was one thing.
His first actual decision was to put me on
Put Me On Very Good Kiss.
I thought you coming back was an Anthony King parting decision. Okay, so then Very Good Kiss.
It's worth noting that while Anthony cut me, I talked to him. He was very nice about it. I had a meeting with him, and he was very nice.
And at the time, and I feel like this might be the same for you, is like, when I got cut, in retrospect, needed to be cut.
Oh, most definitely.
You feel the same way?
And I would say even now, 4 years later, the 2 or 2.5 months while I was cut are probably two of the best improv months of my career, life, whatever. Yeah. I had so much fun, was making great moves, was listening harder than ever. It was like a thing taken off of me. It was A lot of it was this. I think if I can, you know, because I think this is worth being on here. Is
of course.
It was this. I was, instead of being me on Harold Knight, I was trying so hard to be what I thought they wanted to be. Meanwhile, they put you on because they like what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And that was a big part of it. Like, all of us on Monster were trying so hard to be something other than the way we already played.
And part of the thing with Monster is I think everyone put expectations on what that team was supposed to be. So it's even more pressure of like, what are we fitting into? Right?
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And you know, high expectations on ourselves, high expectations externally. But then I realized, oh, I thought I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, and I got cut. So what that meant was that was the wrong mentality. Like, that didn't work.
Yeah.
Like, if that worked, I would have been on Harold Knight forever, right? So then that helped me switch my mentality, and I couldn't have done that without a clean break. I would have been able to justify, you know, what's the word for it? Rationalize anything except being cut.
Right.
So you've been on 7 different teams, but within that, so many of those teams have had lineup changes that there's probably a dozen, like, not worth. Renamed teams, but a dozen worth of individual
versions
lineups.
Of teams.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Romance kind of fluidly turned into Sherlock and Cookies, and there were like 19 people on that,
Jesus
on those two teams put
Christ.
Together. Yeah.
Okay. So, favorite lineups, favorite iterations of teams, favorite periods of time on Harold Knight?
Oh, man. I really loved being on Very Good Kiss. That was a blast. And then you got put on the like last two shows or something like that, three weeks. And that was probably my favorite time.
I will say, as your roommate, watching you get on Very Good Kiss after being cut, I think maybe I was cut at the time, or I don't remember what it was, but I remember seeing you on that team and being like, oh, finally Matt's getting to play like Matt.
Yeah.
Where I think in other times there was that cloud of Harold Knight over your head.
Mm.
And with Very Good Kiss was the first time where I was like, oh, he's having fun.
Well, a lot of that is I think I have a bad time as a quitter. I have a bad time nailing down how I'm doing or what I'm doing right. Like, and being able to articulate that to myself with confidence. I may know it, but I'm not willing to commit to it. And be like, yes, that is what I'm doing. And when Nate Dern called me and said, if you'd like to come back to Harold Knight, I'd like to put you on Very Good Kiss. He said, I think right now they're kind of struggling with playing each other's ideas. And I think that I'm putting you on this team because I think that is a great strength of yours. And so that to me gave me this objective. You know what I mean? Like, it gave me an objective that I already was good at.
Yeah, the objective was like, come be you on this team. That's what's going to help this team.
And also telling you what be you means. Because I think sometimes we're out in the world when we think we know, but we don't know.
Yeah, and since then I've kind of, you know, again, somebody suggesting something and I hang my hat on it. I think that's like...
I think I've said Jesus more times in this episode.
That's very funny.
That's to be expected with me in the room.
So Very Good Kiss was one of those times, right?
Very Good Kiss was one of those times because it did feel very, like, objective-based, which is, I think, always easy. It's like that idea of... It's like a concept of game. We like boundaries. Like, let's create ourselves some boundaries. So I had like, a little, you know, sheep's pen to run around in.
And also, you were rewarded. Like, that was a team that got good slots based on good shows.
Yeah, definitely. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Very Good Kiss was the first team to put Sandino out of the anchor slot since they had gotten it.
Ooh.
I think we shared it with Grandma's Ashes and then got it for a month and then was back off it. But that was definitely something cool as someone who had been on teams that had struggled.
Yeah. Right.
To finally do the anchor show is like, ooh, I've made it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was really, really excited to be put on a team with Lauren Conlon Adams, which was the next team I was put on, Johnny Romance, because she is like an improv best friend of mine kind of thing.
Great person, awesome.
Just really wonderful human being. But we did like musical improv together, which was an Eliza Skinner taught ASP. We had taken... Some
another
stuff.
Class
been on
that
indie teams.
Another class I watched you have like breakout moments in. Even saw those shows too, right?
Yeah, because Chris Scott was in that. That became Gusto.
Yeah,
such good shows.
That was really man, and I can't recommend musical improv enough to people who are feeling like they stall in scenes because when you are doing a scene, in my opinion, a good improv song, the chorus or the hook or whatever is basically the game. And then the verses are, you know, moves on that. And with a beat, and a rhythm, you just got to keep going.
You have
going
to do
and
it.
You
got to
come up with
stop.
More stuff. And, yeah. And so as someone who was stalling a lot, that definitely helped me push through that.
So right now, yeah. where are you at? You've been on seven teams. You're now on Some Kid.
Some
right?
Kid. Yeah.
New team with some new people.
Yeah.
You feel like the veteran on that team, right?
I mean, de facto, but like right. The other veterans, Sal Gentile and Chris Wiener, are very veteran.
Right.
You know,
how do you, well, I guess my question is, how do you feel in general right now on Herald Night? Having done it for years, having gone through teams and being cut and being put back on, is it still, does it still have that same magic?
It's interesting. I think without having been on this team yet, I would have said yes, but in a different way. I don't mean this in a negative way at all. I say this because after the first show, I went back to the, after Some Kid's first show, it was five people on that team's first Herald Night show.
Right.
They'd been on Lloyd Amba's first Herald Night show. I went to the back and was like ready to just like chat about the show. And was like, you know, in 5 years on Herald Night mode. And people were like, oh man, I was so nervous.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I didn't even think about that. Like I had not really considered how maybe you might still go up to Herald Night and be like really, really nervous. Sometimes you're nervous, but for the most part now, it's a very different experience
than
the beginning. Don't,
yeah, it's like kind of ritual at this point.
Improv still has magic,
of course. Of course.
And Herald Night is a, for me, is a special place because I've done a lot of my favorite things and played with a lot of my favorite people and been, there's something really cool about being told you're improvising with these people as opposed to picking them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely something about that stage in Chelsea with a full crowd of people who are just pumped to see you do stuff. And I don't know. I would say absolutely. A lot of people left at this break. A lot of people decided that it was...
Yeah, a lot of peers of yours.
Yeah, a lot of peers of mine decided it was over.
And I'll say from conversations with you, me and you have had the conversation about you leaving Herald Night lots of times.
Many times.
And I think
literally every time there's an audition coming, I've had the same G-chat conversation with you. This was the first time I didn't have it.
Yeah.
Well, it's just interesting to me to know.
I don't know.
It's interesting to me to know that mindset that's kept you in it. Because you haven't. I mean, you've had many opportunities, many reasons to, jobs, reasons to leave, but you've stayed. And I'm interested in that because I feel like I would be doing, you know, I'd be in the same place, you
I think
know?
It's also, I don't think this is rude to say, you haven't been on the easiest teams.
Yeah, sometimes it's been pretty difficult.
I would say for the majority of it, right?
Yeah,
you've
maybe.
Been on teams that, or at the very least, like, not necessarily, like, rewarded teams. Like, you haven't been on teams that were treated like superstar teams.
That's very true. And
you're on teams that people get pulled from a lot.
And before you answer, Matt, to continue framing this question, that being a person who, when they auditioned, had already not given a fuck.
Yeah.
And or not that you didn't give a fuck, but like you were already thinking about quitting, got on a team, and have been literally teetering, I guess.
Yeah.
And
you
been
were cut.
Cut.
You were told you could
you
go.
But
were told you could leave.
So
but then somebody told
I admire
me back.
Something. There's something about that kind of makes it like shit. I mean, maybe this, you have to do this. I mean, this is just something that. It, I don't know. Maybe it's your destiny.
Well, a lot of times it's my destiny to be on Herald Night for 45 years.
No, I just mean there's something
God
to
bless.
It.
Good Could for be. You.
And
you
enjoy,
and you still enjoy it. And that's what I think. My question is, how do you continue to enjoy it?
Mm.
I think you continue to enjoy it by knowing what it is, and that to me is a lot of it. And a lot of times, what happens is you're not just going to leave something. You're probably going to go to something else, especially if it's not torturous.
Right.
And sometimes it's difficult, but difficult is not necessarily a bad thing. But when it is difficult and bad, you're wondering what you're giving up, of course. And a lot of times you're like, well, what do I fill that time with? What do I fill that energy with, that love, that creativity? And at every time when, so far, at every time when something was, it was Herald Night or something else, I would think about it and I would, you know, chew on it sometimes for months. And I would be like, hey, I'd rather be doing Herald Night. I'd rather be going to Chelsea on my Tuesdays and doing this and finding a way to make it work with people and even when it's tough. Sometimes it would be like, sometimes it would just be my own, like, self-consciousness, but like almost like predictive self-deprecation of like, well, I'm going to get cut, so I might as well quit.
Right. So it's like almost
that's
a defense mechanism.
A lot of times.
Yeah. And I don't think that's fair to anybody, myself, the team.
Yeah.
Not that I would share that with, I never shared it with anybody because it wouldn't have been fair, or the artistic director and the way that they look at things. But it was definitely worth thinking about. But that's a control thing. That's just like I want to take control of this thing I feel like I don't have control over. But in terms of enjoying it and knowing what it is, what I realized it is fun. It's like I do it like everything you're saying is like I do it by choice.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to choose to do it, I don't have to do it. Nobody has to do it. So and sometimes I think people feel like they have to, or they feel like they have to get on a team, or they feel like once they're on a team, they have to stay on a team. And if you really are disenjoying it, then don't do it. But I realized, I was like, oh, man, when it's good, I need it. Like sometimes and this timing is part of it, because like sometimes I'd be in just a rut, hate everything that's going on with it, and have a show where our team
helps, where it
did feel like magic. And it was like, oh, well, I can't chance that I'll never get to feel that again.
Yeah.
And then, so knowing that all it is fun, and knowing it's the kind of thing where you get out of it what you put into it, became
I think
very motivating.
What you're saying is incredibly important, and it's probably something that we, having been on teams, we've all learned. But what you think Herald Night is when you're trying to get on it, and in your early days of Herald Night, is not really what it is.
Yeah, that's so true.
Because what you're saying is 100% right. The Matt Mayer that got on his first team, talking to this Matt Mayer now, would have huge disagreements on what Herald Night is.
I think so.
And I think that's what sometimes can make it difficult to be on, when you're putting Herald Night on this pedestal that it doesn't really need to be on. In the end, it's just another show with people you get to perform with. And yes, you should work hard, but if you're making it too much, it can be too much.
If I can just kind of piggyback off that, or the opposite, which is that it's some rung on a ladder that I got to.
Right.
And
now, since
I'm still on this ladder, I've got to move up the next rung. And so you're thinking of it as below you.
Right.
And that
I'm wired on the weekend. I got to move to the weekend.
Why am I not on the
and
weekend?
And if you're not just thinking, I'm having fun right now, I should be having fun, you're not going to be in the moment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dressbowl.
That kind of goes into my, because most of what you've been talking about is like Tuesday nights and showing up on Tuesday nights. But I think the biggest part of Herald Night and the biggest thing that makes people step away is practices. 3-hour practices,
sure.
An entire weeknight gone every week, a lot of work. You feel like you've been doing it forever. What are your feelings on those 3-hour practices?
I mean, it's improvising.
Right.
I mean, I feel like this is again about the reframing it and knowing what it is. Because I do think it's pretty easy to feel like you're giving up a night for the show. Like you're doing it Tuesday, but you have to practice Thursday, so you're giving up Thursday for Tuesday. It's like, no, I want to improvise. I mean, and some kid has been a blast. These people are very funny and fun to play with and really joyous and very much playing in each other's ideas and building off each other's stuff. So it's, for me, it's like, I look for, this sounds so like such a canned answer, but it is true, is that when it's at its best, I'm really looking forward to it. You know, when I'm feeling my best, I'm really like it's not, oh fuck, I can't do this other thing because because I have practice on Thursdays. It's like, dude, Thursdays are great because you have practice.
Well, me and Dressbowl were talking about this in another episode, how the thing we miss about Herald Night sometimes is just the practice.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like you're definitely the person who could go through 7 years and still enjoy it and figure out that, like, you know, I can have a mindset where this can become monotonous.
Yeah.
But the mindset of enjoying it, I think, is what makes good improvisers on Herald Night.
Is it fair to say you were excited to be on teams with mostly new people, or you wanted to be?
Yeah. The newness, I don't think, was as significant. I think newness is like a related thing to what I was hoping for, which was enthusiasm.
Right.
I really wanted. I found a renewed enthusiasm because I kind of reframed it for myself, and I was feeling like, Hunter Nelson can talk about this a little bit too, I think, which was that we were being called the old team even by ourselves, and I think that's like not a fun.
Right.
I know Hunter hated it, but it's not a fun like assessment of self, and a lot of
You mean Greg?
Greg, with Hunter and And yeah, a bunch of old motherfuckers. no, I mean, we were technically the most veteran team based on like years of experience on Herald Night. And you know, not to get into like child psychology or anything, but like being told what you are will sometimes make you that thing.
So yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, for sure. You're not getting off the back line. Well, I thought I was, but now I'm not.
Yeah, totally. And like sometimes you're just doing, it's a lot of unconscious behavior and all that stuff. But I think sometimes we pigeonhole ourselves into being the old team by calling ourselves the old team. And it started to me to be like, I just want, you know what? I just want to show up. I want eight people to feel young and to, and to like, you know, be spry, is that the word? And go out there and like and do it with that kind
enthusiasm.
Of vibe.
Totally,
you know, like
totally.
So the fact that they're like they happen to be five new people and two people who are newer veterans is I think related, but not necessarily what I was.
It's probably like, tapping into that same excitement of daddy, like new, hungry, enthusiastic about the work you guys are doing. And that, you know, you're always striving for that, I think.
Yeah, and we show up and we do, like, 3 hours of, like, real practice and considering stuff and the coach, you know, like, what the coach says is gospel. And I like that kind of attitude, especially because of, like, what Monstro was like. What I was like on Monstro, being like, hey, whatever that guy says, here's how you improvise. You know, it's like, it's no way for an improviser to behave. And everybody on this team is very much like wanting to do the best Heralds, but not freaking out about it. You know what I mean?
Well,
I
was good. Caring, but not worrying.
Caring, but not worrying.
I will say, Matt, as a veteran in this community and on Herald Night, and I think what I hope people take away from talking to you and seeing you improvise is, you can be an asset to your team and you can be an asset to the community, but you can do that in a way that's not unhealthy mentally. And I think you figured out how to figure out that healthy balance of being on a team and support the team and all that good stuff. And I think that's a huge thing to get over on your first team, is that there's
really
a mental hurdle you have to go over.
I mean, it's not a coincidence that I'm the person who's been on Herald Night the longest and I'm just figuring this out.
You know what I mean?
Like there's definitely something to like watching other people be cut, move to LA, get jobs that, I mean, to reframe that a little bit, part of I think my relaxedness is feeling comfortable in my comedy career.
That too, yeah.
So it makes it very much a choice. It makes it so like I'm not clinging to comedy by clinging to Herald Night, because if I quit Herald Night, I would still have
other things
going.
Totally.
But that has nothing to do with Herald Night. That has everything to do with going out and doing other things in comedy. Where was I going with that?
You're getting that mental health, like figuring out how to mentally assess being on a team, and
I feel like it took me a while, and I feel there. I'm sorry, I'm off my point.
I'm gonna jump in.
Yeah,
and
jump
you can
in.
Think about. I'll make noise, and you can keep thinking about what you're trying to say. Because I do think part of what I love about this is that I don't know anybody who thinks it's as important as you do. You think it's important and you believe in it mattering and it having stakes. But to see you still have, I don't know, to see somebody believe that it's important but not freak out about it is great. I feel like it's such a binary. It's like you either are like, ugh, who cares about Herald Night? Like, let it go. Herald Night's the thing you do on Tuesday while you're working on your character reel.
But that's a thing people tell themselves.
Yes, I know.
And that's never a truth for anybody.
I know, but I hate that branding, or I hate that talking about it. But I love that you've figured out a way to continue to believe that it matters without being the other side of it, which is panicking.
If I can draw a little bit of a personal analogy here that maybe is weird, I feel like that's the truth, right? Like, you don't do yourself any service by telling yourself a complete lie.
Oh, you mean it would be a lie to say it doesn't matter?
It would be a lie to say it doesn't matter. It makes you, you then create stuff, but that stuff is created on a lie, and maybe that works for temporarily, but it doesn't last.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes me think about how I tend to have this thought a lot of like, we're just bags of chemicals, and like we just kind of are based on like random stuff, and you know. It brings me comfort to think about how we're just like stardust that rearranged itself based on like evolutionary principles of the universe, and that there isn't other things governing that, it gives me comfort because it feels very real to me. So if you can find what's actually a truthful truth to you, you can then build on that into a better reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you got to be honest with yourself.
You got to be honest with yourself.
If
you are so worked up about it that you're like, I'll just tell myself it doesn't matter, that doesn't help
you
because you're lying to yourself.
And you're building your comfort on a lie, which eventually shall crumble.
Mm-hmm. And when you're at your most comfortable.
Yeah.
So, like, in the worst possible way.
Yeah, you're 100% a person who's honest with themselves.
Yeah.
In a healthy, so maybe unhealthy way sometimes.
And I got to say, and I it would be unfair for me to not say it, and Sean, you're going to hate this, but a lot of that has to do with my wife.
I almost said it before, but I didn't.
We
got to
end this episode. I don't want to talk about Matt's wife anymore. Sarah, I love you, but we're talking improv, baby. Ins and outs, yes ands, tag outs.
What do you mean tag outs? What are you talking about?
No, I would agree, and to agree with you, I think... And this was part of my best man speech. Sarah basically turned you into a normal human being.
Oh, yeah. Not a normal human being.
Oh, my God. It's
above
so true.
And beyond, I think.
I'm glad that's so the note that we'll be ending this episode on.
Me too.
Durfee, if you're listening, you can email me anytime you want. Matt, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. We could talk to you. I mean, there's so many things we didn't even get to talk about.
I know.
Part of it just feels like some of it might be too personal, but... Maybe we'll have you on the podcast another time. Matt, you're one of the greatest. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks so much.